Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule. It's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to. Joining me today is nobody. This is another Luke solo podcast. While I'm away, I'm 5 weeks on the road or 5 weeks at sea. I'm doing 4 different cruises on 3 different cruise ships, so lots of work, and I'm working on other projects. But I thought I'd have time now to slot in this podcast of a book that, yes, I finished like 2 days ago. It's Ancillary Justice by Anne Leckie. And we had put this, me and Juliana decided this should be on the SFBRP must read science fiction list. And this is a list of like 50 books that we made like a year and a half ago now. And for episode 550, and the books are, what does it say here? Best examples of science fiction available to read today, or which books are the best for those wanting a deeper dive into science fiction, and which old books stand the test of time, and which new books will we still be thinking about in decades to come? And that's what this episode is kind of talking about. Like, it's a new book, but it's been more than a decade since it came out, and is it still seen as a good book? And the context for this is that the last episode that I did, I reviewed a book called Startide Rising by David Brin, which for some reason I gave 4 stars. I listened back to the audiobook and was like, this is like a 2-star book at best. And I took it off the SFBRP list. And it made me think, there's actually just 2 books which have a lower than 4-star rating on the SFB by me, or by me and Juliana, if we rated it and reviewed it together. That is Starship Troopers, which I gave 3.5 stars. And I reread that last year or 2 years ago, whenever it was, recently. And I was like, well, even if it's not the most enjoyable book or the best written book or whatever, it's kind of like important as a touchstone, or as a book that lots of other books are later in dialogue with. It's like Starship Troopers is foundational to what we now can consider like the last 60 years of science fiction. And how military science fiction is treated. It all goes back to Starship Troopers. And there's another book, which I also had given 3.5 stars to, which is, again, Anne Leckie's Ancillary Justice from 2013. And even though I only gave it 3.5 stars at the time, in 2013 or 2014 when I read it, I was like, it feels like it's an important enough book to deserve its place on the list, because it's not just sort of like it won the Hugo. It didn't just win the Hugo and the Nebula. It won let me have a look here on the Wikipedia page, the Hugo Award, the Nebula Award, the Locus Award, the Arthur C. Clarke Award, the British Science Fiction Association Award, and other awards which are less well known for. And it was nominated for the James Tripty Jr. Award, the Philip K. Dick Award, the Crompton Award. I even saw here on Ancillary Justice, it was a nominee for Reader's Favorite Science Fiction of 2013. So this is like the most award-winningest science fiction book of, you know, ever, because it's the first book which has won so many of these awards all at the same time. So I thought, well, it probably deserves its place just for that. So I decided to check it out. Previously, when I read it, I read it as an ebook on the Kindle, and that's because it wasn't available as an audiobook yet when I reviewed it. So I reviewed it before it won all of these awards. And I'll get onto that in a minute, but I just want to say that the... listening to it as an audiobook now, I thought it was pretty good. The narrator, the audiobook narrator, is someone who I've heard quite a bit. Adjoa Ando is the narrator, who again I recognize from lots of other books over the last, you know, again 15 years or however long I've been listening to audiobooks. And I think it's a good narration. It's a little bit flat in some places, a little bit dry. And also, I do think there's some unfortunate accent choices where suddenly someone will pop up and then suddenly have an accent. And I'm like, oh, now I'm having to disconnect my, sort of my like Hollywood influenced prejudices against somebody who pops up in a story with this accent. And I was like, but I don't like, am I meant to feel racist against this person? Because there's suddenly like an accent which is sort of like begs you to feel racist against them. I don't know. It was a bit tricky to suddenly have random accents dropped in to the story at random points, but otherwise pretty good reading. I'm not gonna like knock this book at all for anything wrong with the reading, because again I read it the first time as an ebook and didn't have any of those problems. So As I said previously on the previous episode, when I did a previous podcast about this, I gave it 3.5 stars. And I just listened back yesterday. I listened back to that episode and I had lots of complaints. In fact, I kind of went into it saying, I thought I kind of mostly enjoyed the book, but I had lots of complaints. And then the whole book is loads of complaining. At the end, I was like, yeah, 3.5 stars. Because this time, spoiler for the rest of this review, I'm going to bump up the review. I think this might be the first time I've ever reread a book and enjoyed it more on the second time. Often I'll reread a book from years ago and I'll be like, nah, doesn't hold up quite as well as I thought. Oh, this was really exciting. It was really new back then. And now it's sort of like, yeah, maybe it's not so new anymore. Other people have done other stuff better and I rate it down. And here I'm going to increase the rating from 3.5 stars to 4 stars. Because when I went into this book the first time, my expectations were really high. It had all the buzz, the best book of 2013. And with that hype, it went on to win the Hugo and the Nebula and all these other kind of stuff. So I realized that we're listening back to this previous podcast, which I'm not going to go through that many notes about. But what it was is that I was reading it and comparing it to like really great science fiction of the past. For example, I was like, it's someone who's like playing in the same space as Ian M. Banks, because you know it's a bit about the spaceships in this book, and I'll get into a lot more of this in a minute. But like the spaceships are talking, and there's an interesting weapon, and this other kind of stuff. So it's like begging to be compared to Ian M. Banks. And then there's like the gender treatment where everybody is referred to as a she, so everybody is like, there's like this neutral gender that the narrator always uses. And I'm like, yeah, but now you're just doing. Now you're doing like Left End of Darkness, so I'm comparing it to Ursula K. Le Guin, and there's like this whole stuff on a cold planet where they're doing an ice slog through the ice across a whole a planet, and then you know you're going along with someone who needs your help, but you're not quite sure what gender they are, and there's like a weird relationship which isn't based on you know being a male and female or whatever it is, and there's this ambiguous, and you're like, well, so I go into this, and I'm comparing it all the time to Ian M. Banks and Ursula K. Le Guin and Alistair Reynolds and like these greats of who are doing the same kind of thing in space opera science fiction. So all, you know, most of my complaints were like, it doesn't stack up against these, you know, greats of space opera writing. And so some examples of that is like the structure was disappointing because it felt like it was trying to do a use of weapons kind of structure, but then it kind of fell apart a bit as well. The plotting wasn't very good. There was all this like very convenient stuff happening, like meeting someone from your past and then meeting someone else from your past and then meeting someone else from your past. There's a lot of like this coincidences in series that are very convenient. Oh, and this is very, oh, that's very convenient. Oh, and then this happens and that's very convenient as well. Like, again, just some of the plotting didn't work out. And and also past Luke in previous episode was like, you know, it's kind of bland as a space opera except for like these three really strong ideas. Like there's this generic space station and they go to a generic planet and it's not very imaginative except for, like I say, like three or four things or two or three four things. And I said something like, if you're gonna have some like weird alien artifact, then you've got to at least match like in Ian M. Banks or an Alistair Reynolds' least imaginative alien artifact for your most imaginative artifact. So the most imaginative, the most creative, the most best descriptions of everything wasn't even getting close to like the worst, most sort of like throwaway lines that you would get in other great science fiction. The things that I really like about it and this book this time through, I really like that the minds of the ship isn't just sort of like one monolithic artificial intelligence. It's got all these ancillaries, these human, like reanimated zombie human elements that you can have these different, parts of it, you know, sort of like there's the Justice of Torren ship, is the ship, but then you've got all of these, you know, the decks, the different decks have like lots of people on there, and each deck has like a squadron, and each squadron has like 20 different of these ancillaries, these human, reanimated human dead people whose minds have mostly been wiped and they're being controlled. Again, the whole idea that a ship can be controlling a human has been done before in the Culture series, but this has been done in it's a better way. And then what if one of those goes on and is the only surviving part of an otherwise hive mind ship? That is all really good. All of that good is in the book. It's a really great exploration of that, and that's really good. The other thing I like is that the leader, the let me have a quick look at the Goodreads page here so I can see this character's name. This Ananda Mienanaya is like this hive mind leader of the Empire, and I really like the idea, again, mild spoilers here, but there's like a war going on inside a hive mind where two different parts of the hive mind have got different motivations, and they're kind of going up against each other, but because it's a mind, they can't reveal that to each other. So the hive mind hasn't admitted to itself yet that it is in conflict, even though it's admitted to other people. Like all of this stuff, there's lots of really good stuff in here as well. But again, previous Luke, when I read this in 2013, 2014, and gave it 3.5 stars, I was thinking it is lesser, like traditional great science fiction. Which brings me to this time reading it. My expectations wasn't that like I'm comparing it now to Ian M. Banks and Ursula K. Le Guin. What I'm doing is I'm reading it as an early example of the kind of dominant movement of science fiction. And when I say dominant, I mean dominant in the awards, dominant on the Hugo Awards and the Nebula Award nominations, the dominant movement there, which is variously called Tall Wave or Squeakor. We've talked about Squeakor, Tall Wave, or Tall Wave, Squeakor quite a lot on the podcast over the last 7 or 8 years. Didn't have any names, but this is a book which was right at the heart in the Hugo nomination kind of drama around the sad puppies and the rabid puppies. And the reaction against that, which was to say, like, no, we do actually want, you're complaining that is like affirmative action and rewarding, you know, women writing science fiction, or what is it, minorities writing science fiction is bad. And the reaction to that is that for like years and years, there wasn't a single straight white male even getting onto the nomination list for the Hugo Awards. Again, I'm not going to say, you know, that's good or bad or whatever. That's not my point here. Is that this book, Ancillary Justice, is like ground zero for the wave of science fiction. Again, mostly written by women, mostly written by, or a lot of more representation in terms of the authors, in terms of gender and race. Again, but at the same time, almost overwhelmingly American, and from a very kind of narrow point of view. And this is what the criticism of this is, and what kind of like the conversations about Squeakor, and which again, this is way, way later than this book, which is from like 2022, which is sort of like going into these things, which I made some notes here as well. It's sort of like the progressive liberal bourgeois ideological framework. And you're like, all right, that's here as well. And the kind of all this like triumphalism. And I'm like, yep, that's right here in the book. Problems being solved without meaningful effort on the part of heroes. Everything comes to the heroes easily, and they never meaningfully struggle or fail. At the end, they just walk through all the bad guys and win. And I was like, oh, that's right here at this point as well. Entitled or self-absorbed characters. And I'm like, yep, that's very, very right here again in this book. Protagonist-centered morality. And I'm like, yep, it's all there as well. The kind of like the might makes right kind of like, and I was like, yeah, this book is literally about who has the bigger gun wins the battle, you know. And so I was like, right, I'm gonna go into this book like looking at this book not as an extension, or like, or maybe looking at this book as a turning point from science fiction as written by like Ian, like space opera as written by Ian M. Banks, Ursula K. Le Guin, and these other people who are writing like these expansive worlds. And it was about the setting. It was about all these other kind of stuff. And then like turning the door into being like, oh no, now the focus is characters in a world which might be science fictional, but the science fictional elements we can just assume are there, in the same way that when you're watching a science fiction movie, you can just assume that there's going to be a spaceship. You don't need to describe it. It's just there. It's not about what it's like to get into a spaceship and fly to from one planet to another. Sort of like, no, that's just in, you know, the characters will do that, but we're not going to do long descriptions of spaceships. We're not going to do long descriptions of, you know, planets or all this other kind of stuff, which was generally the core of the more traditional space opera. Is actually the setting was as important, but now it's much more interior to the characters. It's like anything that the character doesn't care about, you as a reader don't need to do that. And again, this is reflected in like this Torwave Squeak or a bit more, in that it's very like centered in, or like the influence comes down to what it's like to, what is science fiction if you assume that everybody has the same science fictional movie and TV based science fictional foundations. And that's always what it comes down to. A lot of the complaints is that it's sort of like the character is like very Firefly. It's very Josh Whedon-esque, a lot of that kind of stuff. Now, this book doesn't have that, but there's a lot of this kind of stuff in here. So that's what I reread it. And I must admit that as a book, which is illustrating the turning point from more traditional science fiction space opera into like Torwave Squeakor, with, again, all of the good stuff that comes with that, which is like representation and, you know, all of the, you know, more diverse people writing, more diverse characters in the book, concentrating a lot more on gender. Although, again, of course, people, Ian M. Banks does that with the Culture series because, you know, he has people swapping genders. It's very much more gender fluid in the Culture series than anything in this book. And again, Ursula K. Le Guin was talking about gender, but like this now becomes kind of foregrounded, but also irrelevant, because this same story could have been told in a way which is like the gender, like the main character could just be able to tell the genders more interestingly. All of the characters have genders, but the main character, it just isn't referencing them. And so, yeah, it's really strange that like in a book like Accession by Ian M. Banks, one of the main storylines is the characters are having babies, like the two characters are having babies with each other. And so what they do is the man impregnates the woman, and the woman holds on to the baby, to the zygote inside. Then they both change genders, and then who was once the woman is now the man, impregnates the man, and who was once the man, who is now a woman, and they both get pregnant, and then they both switch their genders to to female, or the other one switches the genders to female, and then they both can gestate the babies and give birth at the same time. And I'm like, all right, if we're going to talk about gender stuff, that is like a main foundation of the story, and it's one of the driving factors behind what it, in the same, in say, you know, we're going over to Ursula K. Le Guin with The Left Hand of Darkness. Again, all of that book is dependent on like what political structures would be like if, you know, gender wasn't a thing, or if there's three genders, again, like in some of the Ian M. Banks books. So again, but the way that this, like the Torwave Squeakor kind of does it, it's often that like they'll be talking about gender, but the gender discussions that are going on isn't to do with like society-wide things. It's much more to be like, what is this character experiencing in this moment due to their gender or due to whatever? Again, being very reductive of that, but I'm just saying it's a kind of theme that comes out through this more, you know, recent dominant form of, what to say, sort of like character-based storytelling, with the science fiction elements and storytelling elements kind of having been filtered through general understanding of science fiction via TVs and movies and all that kind of stuff. So this book is a really good example of, like, say, an early turning point and kind of like foundational to what came later in these things. Again, with all of the good stuff that comes with it and the bad stuff, because again, I find the politics in this book is like, it's all over the place. But again, it's sending the right signals to the right in-group of science fiction readers, and then of course later on science fiction writers. And again, a lot of the conversation in 2022, 2023 about this dominant form was that it's like overwhelmingly upper middle class American, and that there's genders being represented and race being represented. What isn't being represented is anyone from any class which isn't in the in-group of the, as I say from this notes that I read here, the progressive liberal bourgeois ideological framework is the thing that is there. Feeling in the end very American in that you can say empire is bad and or corporations are bad, and then the characters in the book just continue on the actions of the corporations and the empire, but because it's now an individual who has the right politics or an individual who has the right representation, and they do exactly the same actions as all the bad people. But because they have the right pronouns, or they have the right background, or they have the right racial identity, suddenly it's fine for them to continue on with exactly the same morality. And that's kind of like the protagonist-centered morality, which is sort of like, I'm the protagonist, so if I do it, it's fine. But if the bad people do it, it's really bad. So that is one of the things that I like. And again, this is a very meta way of talking about this book. I like this book because it is... As an example of all this kind of stuff, it does actually have better ideas in it than a lot of these later Tor Wave books that come along. And you're like, oh, right, all you're doing now is playing with the toys that books like Ancillary Justice and these other early books kind of came up with, or were like saying, this is what we can do now. And everyone's like, right, this is what we can do now. For example, at the end of the previous podcast that I recorded in 2014, I made a note here as well. Oh yeah, I said, because I was talking about like, right, it's really kind of refreshing to read a story where there aren't like always genders around, like labeled genders. So when two characters get together, if it's a male and a female, I'm like, oh, is this going to be a love interest? Or if it's a male or a male and you know the sexual orientation, you're like, okay, this is definitely not going to be a love interest, but it's going to be this kind of drama between alpha males. Or if it's two women, you're like, oh, what's it going to be like here? And not having that, each character that comes up is just a name and you don't know what biological gender or whatever they're going to have. And I was like, I really want more books like this. I want more non-specific gender stories. And then as I listened to myself at that, I was like, oh yeah, that I said that in 2013 or 2014 that I wanted that. But then a lot of the episodes that we've done since then, like since whenever I did this episode going all the way back in 2013, I must admit I am often quite annoyed by how much I've complained about people going, and I'm like, no, I wanted much more non-specific gender stories, but you're using the wrong pronouns or you're trying it out. And I'm like, oh right, I thought I wanted that. But in the end, it's kind of, you kind of get overloaded with every new author going, I need to have like some non-binary people in my story and I'm going to experiment with this. And I'm like, is it your job as a straight, you know, cisgendered whatever author to be to using other people's gender expressions as a playground for talking about science fiction or whatever like that? And while again it's interesting to have that representation there, I'm like, oh, actually I quite kind of liked this very hands-off approach, that this is kind of a little bit of world building and a sort of expresses more about the single character involved rather than making statements about all of gender or all of non-binary or all of trans or all of non-specific gender stories or whatever like that. Again, there's not criticism in this book, I'm just saying that how this book is actually more hands-off in terms of gender than most books since, or a lot of books since, even though at the time it felt like it was kind of like a big part of the story. And reading other people's reviews, lots of people say, oh, it's just too confusing. I don't know if it's a male or a female. And I was like, oh, no, that's what I wanted. I liked the fact that I didn't know it was a male or female and could just like develop my own opinions on the character by their actions and thoughts and statements rather than by, other stuff. I don't know. It's quite interesting to read all that stuff. Again, especially from reviews back in like 2013, 2014. So that's the first part of this review. Now, the part that I was more surprised about is that I went into this thinking, I'm trying to find my place in my notes here. I thought this was just going to be like this, a book which like showed the new direction into tall wave squeak or domination of the Hugos and Nebulas and stuff, that kind of stuff. And I thought this was going to be like a founding text of that. And I was like, it's interesting to read, historically interesting to read because of that. And it was. And that's what I found. What I didn't expect to find is that this is also one of the founding texts of what is now known as more cozy science fiction. And this is not cozy science fiction. Ancillary Justice is not cozy science fiction. But a lot of the stuff that is in cozy science fiction can be found here. Because again, I think one of the main points of cozy science fiction, and this is when Juliana and I, we were talking about The Long Way to the Small Angry Planet by Becky Chambers. The whole point of that book is that it's kind of, I say the whole point of it, but one of the reasons why it's called cozy is that the stakes at any one point are quite low. Of course, they're trying to deliver some kind of, I don't know, what is it like a, I can't even remember because I didn't finish the book this time I read it. But they have to get like a wormhole from here to there, and they've got to go the long way round, and they could do it quicker, but because they can't take a wormhole through a wormhole, they've got to deliver it this way. So the stakes are, you know, okay-ish, but quite low. And since then, cozy science fiction, the stakes have just been getting smaller and smaller. It's never about, like, the universe needs saving, or the galaxy is safe, or there's going to be an assassination of an important person and we've got to stop it, or there's been a murder and we need to catch the killer, or whatever. It's always a bit more like, no, let's bring it down. We've got three people, or two people, and one of them wants to go to bed, and the other one wants to find some tea or whatever it is. And that's the kind of stakes that we're going to have. Oh, this person wants to find happiness in life. And so this book is not that. It's missing the lack of stakes. But then a lot of the stuff which is then later in these, also, you know, the tall wave squeak or kind of stuff, it's also in, this is also kind of, is a prelude to what's in the cozy science fiction. For example, everything working out for the protagonist just by them being a good person. Like, all I need to do is, in any situation, all I need to do is do the right moral thing, and that's fine. And I'm like, yep, that's here as well. If you just do the right thing, things will work out well for both you and the people around you. And I'm like, great, no dramas there. Another note that I made as I was listening to this audiobook, I was like, when I was listening to this before, I was looking at this kind of thing, sort of like, oh, what's the AI kind of ramifications of this artificial intelligence and stuff. And now I'm reading it, thinking, oh, this. Breck, the main character, not being able to pick up on social cues, I'm like, this is very much now can be read as an analogy of a main character on some kind of spectrum, autism spectrum, or whatever spectrum you want to say, not being able to pick up on social cues, and that she's humming all the time, and people saying, you know, you're humming all the time, and I'm like, someone who's humming, and then you not understanding, like I say, not just that you not understanding social cues, but also other people around you, again, this is part of cozy science fiction, just being completely understanding of your quirks. And it's kind of like this weird fantasy that having any like neurodivergence isn't going to hold you back, because everyone around you is just going to be completely understanding, and they're just going to give you all the time and space that you need, and if you make mistakes, they'll just forgive you, and none of your like neurodivergence is going to have any negative effects on your life or anybody else around you, but we'll represent you here in this fiction, but then everything's going to be okay, because everyone understands your quirks as well. And that's, you know, that's here as well. Again, this is not a criticism. I'm saying that's what makes this cozy, is that you don't want conflict arising from, you know, something that people can then identify with. Same, but also it has the same kind of weird thing that I've read in some of these other books where, like, the neurodivergence kind of verges into becoming a superpower. Which again is always one that I'm like, but is it really? I'm not quite sure. Again, I'm someone who, I wouldn't say I'm neurodivergent in any way which is recognizable to me. But it's one of those things where I'm like, when I read in science fiction, I'm always like, right, let's just be, I don't see it there, and I just see some, like, I don't want to give people the wrong ideas, that it's sort of like, and all you need to do is be completely yourself at all times, and everything will be okay for you around you, because I've seen people where that isn't the case, again, not through any fault of their own, not even through any fault of other people around you, but you can't just live life assuming that everybody around you will have 100% understanding of your situation and will therefore treat you perfectly and correctly and nobody gets hurt in any way. No, that it just isn't how the world works. But in cozy science fiction, and maybe fantasy, it can be as well. Lots of people drinking tea, which is, and certainly in the next book in this series, tea drinking becomes a big part of it. There's like signaling seriousness thought, or signaling thought, or the seriousness of a thought by quantifying how long someone pauses. This comes up in the murder bot as well. Like, I was silent for 4.2 seconds, and I was like, ah, right. You don't actually have to write how serious your thought was or how serious the situation was. You're quantifying by length of pause actual thought or seriousness rather than by writing into the book what the actual thought or seriousness is. And that allows people to just read into the situation what they think is the thought rather than actually giving it to them. Rather than telling people the main character is thinking this, it's just sort of like they were silent for 4 seconds. And you fill in the gaps here of what you want this character to be thinking about right now. Also, complete lack of sexiness and horniness. Again, in some cozy science fiction, there is maybe some sexiness or horniness, but like, or maybe there's some sex, or maybe there's some love or some romance, but there's no like horniness. Like, you're never going to get turned on reading one of these books or listening to one of these books. There's a complete lack of morals or any consequences for murder or other actions that would be major crimes if it wasn't for the non-protagonist. Or if a non-protagonist did this, they would be major crimes. But because it's the protagonist, oh, I mentioned this before, the protagonist-centered morality. But like in this book, the main character sort of like, and these people, I just killed them. And I was like, oh, it's really pity that those people who were struggling in a planet and they were just trying to get you over, they're like me. And it's one of those kind of things where you're like, ah, yes, of course. I'm not like these mere humans that are struggling. They are poor people. And I'm an inhumanly rich superhuman. And my default to sort out this problem of I'm an inhumanly rich super person is my default is I will just kill them. And if I'm feeling good about them, I'll just injure them. And that's their fault. If I kill them, that's their fault for them inconveniencing me, the inhumanly rich superhuman, while I continue my irrational like quest of vengeance. So because I have an irrational quest of vengeance, if I'm disturbed by some poor people or they want to take advantage of me rather than me taking advantage of them, what they do is they get killed and I don't. And then the book carries on and I'm like, all right, so we're dealing with someone who's a complete monster. And then by the end of the book, people are like, oh, Breck, you're the best. I'll do anything for you. And I'm like, weren't you there when she just like randomly murdered these people for inconveniencing them? And there was ways that they could have done it, like, I don't know, because she is an inhumanly rich superhuman. Anyway, another thing that comes down is this, I made a note of this, is that you get a personal spaceship at the end. And I'm like, this happens over and over and over again in these tall wave squeakcore and also these cozy science fiction. And this is what I remember the review that I did last year when I was talking about the, now I can't remember the name of the book by Emily Tesh. And I will now have to go and have a look at the episode list. Reviewed it like last year. The internet's not working. The satellite internet not working. What is it? Emily Tesh. Oh, Some Desperate Glory. And I gave that 1.5 stars. And part of that review was saying, oh, it's like, it's meant to be sort of like military and battles and stuff. But in the end, it just felt cozy. And one of the signifiers that made it feel cozy is that at the end, you get yourself a, like a found family and a personal spaceship to fly your found family around in. And I was like, oh, why is this in so many of these books that your reward for getting through to the end of the book and doing well? And like, yeah, you murdered lots of people on an irrational quest, but everyone now loves you. And as an reward, you get your own spaceship. And it's like, it feels like the opposite to what happens, like, say, in the culture novels, where the quest, right at the start of the novel, they get given their own personal spaceship, and then they get sent on the quest, and at the end they're like, great, and all I want to do is not have a personal spaceship anymore and just go home and play the violin or play my board games or whatever it's going to be. Like, like instead of being taken out of obscurity. But it's the same kind of thing. Hey, wouldn't a story be really great if I was an inhumanly rich superhuman who was given my own spaceship at the end? And they even say, but you could afford your own spaceship. Why do you need to be given one? And so I'm like, oh, whatever. So this is definitely a book which is in the lineage of these like Murder Bots and Long Way to Small Angry Planets and other cozy science fiction and Tall Wave Screecore, but it isn't one of those things because it kind of predates them, or it's a foundational text, or it was like one of the first expressions or one of the first early expressions of this kind of science fiction based in characters rather than like the science fiction tropes and what would otherwise be, you know, world building in its own right just become backdrop for characters to go on very comfortable journeys where there isn't a lot of challenge happening in either the story or the journey of the characters because they are assumed to be good and assumed to be right and just carry on as well. So it's a crossover point. Later novels in this series become much more cozy and much more about drinking tea. And I was like, yeah, but the first one had teeth, it had grit, and it does have a bit of that. But all of the coziness is already right there as well. So what else do I have to say here? Yeah, pretty, again, that's my main point. Other stuff. Oh yeah, I just said more ice logging. I mentioned that as a reference to Left Hand of Darkness. Can't tell the genders. Yeah, I mentioned that already. Oh yeah, very much like the Roman Empire, as it's once the Roman Empire is finally bumped up against its limits. So I quite like that. Also, I liked a lot that the characters are based, like a lot of them are based, like what we know about the characters are based on their like ties to other people, their social ties or the ties to society or the place in society, and which I thought was really good. However, that kind of means that a lot of the individual physical attributes of the people aren't ever described. It's sort of like, and now this person had this and they were wearing this, which signified this. And I was like, yeah, but what do they look like? And I was like, ah, maybe you can't describe that too much, because if you do, that would give too many thoughts in my mind if this is a male or female or, you know, whatever gender, whatever's going to be. Even though it says, oh yeah, some places when someone is curvy, it means they're male. And in other places when they're curvy, it means that they're female. So I can't use those things to decide if they're male or female. After having stated that explicitly in the book, the viewpoint character then no longer says anything more about curviness or not curviness or square jawlines meaning male or square jawlines meaning female. But me as a human reader who likes to have like a picture in my mind of the character as they are talking, pretty much most of that was missing. And again, it feels like this is like, oh yeah, just imagine this and now you imagine it. I was like, oh yeah, thank you very much. But like if I was watching a movie, I wouldn't have to imagine it, but it's your job as the author to put there as well. Again, not a big criticism, because again, from the point of view of the character, it makes sense, but I as a reader, I would like a bit more of that. So yeah, my final note is I pretty much already covered this. This is a rare case of where I'm going to increase my rating on the second read because my expectations were so much lower that I went into this just wanting a fun example of this style of book, got more than I wanted out of it, and overall quite enjoyed revisiting a book from the point of view of knowing how much this has influenced so many later books, or how much the things that were influencing this book have gone on to become dominant in science fiction. But this is still kind of claiming a lineage back to Ian M. Banks and Ursula K. Le Guin, whereas a lot of the more recent books in the genre claim a lineage back to literally Firefly or literally Joss Whedon movies or literally, you know, movies and TV shows, rather than, you know, using more classic science fiction and space opera and, you know, writing in response to that. And I think actually having and now reading more Adrian Tchaikovsky, I think what's making Adrian Tchaikovsky so appealing to me and lots of other people is that he is very specifically like skipping over, like he still has, you know, Joss Whedon dialogue, but every book that he writes is very much in dialogue with a more classic science fiction book from either like the 1950s or up to the 1990s, but also up until like 15, 16 years ago, just to the point where this form of tor wave squeakcore was taking over in a dominant form and kind of being the main thing that informs people's what the aesthetics and the tropes are of science fiction. Adrian Tchaikovsky always goes back a little bit further than that and isn't so much in dialogue with these more modern books. Or if so, more to point out, like, again, I'm just reading the book Shroud, and he's like, hey, I'm doing Peter Watts, I'm doing Blindsight here, so come along on the ride with me, or get off the ride or whatever. And yeah, it feels like this. So again, it's much more fun to be happy to read a book without comparing it to Ian M. Banks and Ursula K. Le Guin and Alistair Reynolds and, you know, other space opera from whatever, whenever they were writing. So that's it. I appreciate that it puts in that effort, but I like to see the roots of cozy science fiction and tor wave squeakcore, etc. So that's it. I've reached the end of my notes. Got through them pretty quickly. 40 minutes. That's what happens here. I did enjoy also looking at some other people's reviews of this, because there's a lot of reviews for this. It's got 3.99 average rating here on goodreads.com. First published October 1st, 2013. Yeah, when did it say I read this? It doesn't come up here, because let me click on my review on Goodreads to see when I first reviewed it. Yeah, it would have been 2014, so like probably only 2 or 3 months after it came out, but it had a lot of stuff. Yeah, and then my friends and followers, there's 157 ratings of it. Like, David rated it 5 stars. Diva Diane, 5 stars. James did not finish. Julie rated it 5 stars. And then Terp Kristen, 2 stars. So it's really funny how so many people were like, yeah, it's really great. Tamahomi here, 3 stars. So it's this real big swing of like literally half of the people say, hey, at the start of the book where it was switching between different viewpoints, I really liked it. The world building one was good. The character work was good. The structure was good. It was like one side was reflecting here and the other side was like, we're going back 20 years in the past, now modern day, 20 years. That was all really good. And then it got like half the way through or 2/3 of the way through or whatever it is. There's a crossover point where suddenly this story is streamlined and we just have like straight narrative, what A, B, C, D, E, F, G, all the way through to the end. And people are like, oh, and then it kind of got all flabby and like let down at the end there. And then the other half of the reviews are like, oh, I didn't like it at the start. It was confusing because it was switching between time zones or like 20 years ago and now. And it was really bad. I couldn't tell which planet we were on. I couldn't tell the genders and all this other kind of stuff. And then halfway through, it kind of concentrated down to one storyline. And then it really picked up and it was really great. And I was like, ah, I was definitely of the first. I really enjoyed the first half of this book and the same as well. And then it got to that part where it's sort of like, and that is all the backstory that we need, and now on with the main story where this person is meeting here in this space station and getting revenge or something, something, something. And I was like, oh yeah, remember, this is the turning point where I suddenly enjoyed it less, and the same thing happened here, but again, I knew it was coming, so it was less of a shock. But yeah, it's really funny to read other people's reviews, and it's like, again, even like the 3 and 4 star books where most people mostly enjoyed it, it's like I don't know, it's one of those it's, well, great start, a time to go ending, you know. So people are either like, yeah, great start, or they're like, great finish, but it started well. And yeah, also all my complaints, well, not all my complaints, some of my complaints still stand from the first review, which is sort of like the action sequence is always like, this person has a gun and they're pointing it at something, will they pull the trigger or not? And I was like, can we have some tension or action which isn't just this person is standing here with a gun? And so yes, some better action would have been nice. And again, other criticisms that I had on my first read through, which is, again, it's quite now a bit meta about this podcast now, and the science fiction book review podcast is what I'm talking about. And this, like, the, we are now in January of 2016. I started this in 2008. So we are now, what's that, 16 years into doing this podcast. No, more than that. I'm now 18 years into this podcast. So it's a long enough, the science fiction book review podcast is now a long enough project that I can listen to something that I said 12 years ago. And since saying that, a whole new kind of movement, a whole new wave of science fiction, a whole new kind of like, yeah, like what's acceptable in science fiction, what's not acceptable. It's like this main dominant form of science fiction has come along, and I can listen back to long form rambling Luke, who just didn't get it at the time, didn't understand what was coming, and I can listen back to that, and it's actually quite fun to listen back to, you know, 12 years ago Luke, who didn't know what was coming and didn't know what he was reading at the time, and now I can, and I'm thinking, oh, this is going to keep happening as I do this. Like, books are going to come out and I'm like, oh, this is really great, and what did I think about it? And then, you know, 10 years later the author's going to get cancelled and I can go back and listen to what I liked about the author before that. Whatever, I don't know which authors are being cancelled these days, but there's that kind of stuff can happen, that you can go back and go, ah, back then I didn't know Richard Morgan was a complete, you know, that he was going to be banned from Twitter for being transphobic and now be kind of like cast out of the conversations about science fiction because he's so well known as being transphobic. And then go back and listen to myself reading about that again. One of his books is still here, because I don't think changing, like, disagreeable politics of an author should necessarily exclude you from, you know, if you have an important book in the history of science fiction. Again, that's why I don't mind some of these books or some of these authors' books being on this SFBRP must reads list, even if they're what am I trying to say, their politics isn't exactly what I would go with, or even, but it's more to be like, in the book itself, does the politics get in the way of an interesting story? And in some cases, yes and no. And that's going to keep happening over and over as I go through this. Like, I'm going to listen back to Luke from 12 years ago and have this record of what, not just what my thoughts have changed, but also like what the view of science fiction is and how it's changed, and that I have like a view back on this. And so that's why I've really enjoyed reading back through some of these science fiction must reads, and to see, does this still hold up? Is it still good? Can it still stand up? And I think this book does. I think it actually stands up better now that I know what come after it. Anyway, I'm just repeating myself. So if you want to become my friend so I can also see what you think about these books, go to goodreads.com, become my friend. Head over to the SFBRP listener group on Goodreads. There's a fun... there's some discussions on there, some books that I would like to see reviewed, some episode feedback and other things there as well. It, again, very low levels of volume of conversation there, but I do read all of it. And you can email me as well, luke@juggler.net, if you've got any feedback too. You can't message me on Goodreads anymore. They've removed that functionality, which is good, because I just started getting AI spam or spam, whatever. Obviously spam written by... large language models. But that's the future. That's the science fiction future that we live in, that we have to... If I was younger, you'd say, hey, you can have a conversation with a robot. I'd have been like, amazing, I can have a conversation with an artificial intelligence. It was like, ah, I remember the back in the day when that was the thing and do it. And now I'm like, how can I turn off the option to have conversations with robots? There we go. Anyway, yeah, that's it. Feedback, whatever, email me, Goodreads. You can follow me on Instagram and on Blue Sky and on Mastodon. Don't chat there very much, but I do enjoy reading those as well. So if I follow you there, I can see what you're up to. Anyway, that's it for me. I hope you enjoyed this episode. 4 stars for this book. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.